Armand DeMille here with you with The Positive Mind. Roberta Maria Antti, we were talking about the G-spot and G-spot orgasms, and we were talking about the discovery of this. And we were lucky to be told by one of our associates that, you know, a reminder that many women do not have this experience during childbirth.
Yes, that is the truth, that many modern women do not experience that, and there are
Well, let's say what
reasons.
That is, because people may have just tuned in. We were talking about a G-spot as part of the vaginal canal.
The G-spot, as named after Dr. Ernst Grafenberg, who located it. He was the first one to find it. I guess he was an explorer. He was a gynecologist. We named it after his last name, and it's a spot located in the front of the birth canal of the vagina, right behind the pubic bone. And it's a place where a woman, when that place is stimulated, a woman experiences great pleasure. But for many women, this does not happen. So we explained the theory that Dr. Schlein presents as to why is it even there, since it doesn't seem to be stimulated during normal intercourse. Dr. Schlein asks the question, why is it even there? And he says, well, when you look at the anatomy and physiology of birth, you see that the head of the baby, as it enters the birth canal and as it exits the womb, hits right that place that we call the G-spot and causes the nerves that go from there to the brain to be stimulated and to pump out endorphins in high levels so that the woman experiences a lot of pleasure. Now, this happens. Every woman knows that there is such a thing as childbirth orgasm, and they are like the unicorn. Everyone talks about it, but no one has seen it. And the reason for that may be that today women are forced to deliver, first of all, from a position which is unnatural, which is for most women lying down. When you're lying down, the head of the baby does not come out in the right position. In fact, it often gets stuck in the wrong position, because really a woman's best position to give birth would be standing up and squatting. If you allow the woman to move naturally, if you don't, a lot of women are actually, believe it or not, restrained. The arms and legs are kind of restrained to the birthing bed to prevent her from, I guess, moving too much, I don't know, so that she can't move her body the way that the body would naturally move. But if you allow a woman to move naturally, what will happen is that the brain and the body will get into this synergy of movement. The neurotransmitters secreted in the brain during labor, with all the contractions and the pain, there's an increase of endorphins and dopamine, and all of the neurotransmitters, the norepinephrine, all of them increase slowly, so that by the time the woman is ready to give birth, she's in a kind of a fog. She's in a different world. She's in a world of her own where she feels the pain, but she's also somewhat dissociated from it. At that moment, instinctively, the woman will squat, will bend her knees, and will facilitate the exiting of the head of the baby by moving her body in such a way that it kind of slides out. Well, this is not possible if you're tied and restricted to a birthing bed. That's one reason why this orgasm does not happen. The other reason is that a lot of women are medicated, either with epidurals or with morphine or with Demerol or with some kind of, or with anesthesia, or some complication of birth happens whereby the woman needs to go under general anesthesia.
Just for a minute.
So she doesn't feel anything.
Yeah, just
She's
for
not
a minute,
connected
Roberta.
With it.
Since endorphins are very much like the opiates, if a person is given an opiate at childbirth, I mean, most people who will talk about taking opiates cannot have orgasm, right? I mean, people talk about, you know, when they take drugs, if a woman takes cocaine, she will be unlikely to reach orgasm.
Drugs prevent, yes, prevent because or can what, prevent or, orgasm. Yes.
Because what they are doing is filling the spot that you're looking to get the orgasm from, which has to do with the endorphins.
Receptors, yes.
Yeah, so the receptors are already filled. Of course there is no way. So even if the G-spot is being pressed by the head, if you've got painkillers in your body and they've given you enough painkillers, that's being suppressed, which in effect suppresses this incredible experience that somehow nature built in, which in effect isolates you and separates you from your own baby.
Exactly. In fact, from what I understand, Armand, in more primitive societies where births are not medicated and where they're not controlled in the way they are in our society, and where women are helped during the time of birth, giving birth by other women, so that the whole process happens very naturally with its own rhythms and pace. And what happens is the body of the woman and the body of the child get into this synchronistic movement. It's almost like a dance. The baby moves, the body of the woman moves, and back and forth. And there's this dance that goes on. And the head of the baby moves in such a way that the nerves around the birth canal of the woman are stimulated, so that the brain of the woman is now connected with the brain of the child through the stimulation that happens through the movement. And all these endorphins, you're right, that are produced and secreted and give the woman this incredibly pleasurable experience at the same time as she's experiencing this excruciating pain. Mind you, it's not that this eliminates the pain. Pain is still there. But in that moment, she also feels pleasure more than ever in her life. The endorphins and the oxytocin, this is another hormone we did not bring up yet, but it's time to. Now we're so close to the birth that now in a few minutes or maybe seconds, the woman will make her first encounter with her child. Her nervous system is flooded with hormones that cause her to fall in love immediately. The moment she sees this baby, she smells it. The moment the baby's out, this woman is madly in love with this baby. And remember, the same thing is true for the baby as well, because the baby has gone through an ordeal, so his little nervous system has also produced endorphins. So she falls in love with the mother. But the mother immediately has this experience of love like never before in her life for this creature. And then, intuitively and instinctively, the first thing that a woman will do after this incredible orgasm that she just had with childbirth is she'll put the baby at the breast, where she gives the baby this colostrum, which is a milk that's not quite milk. It's a mixture of milk and other secretions that also convey to the baby immunities, antibodies. So the woman puts the baby at the breast, the baby suckles, and now she produces even more oxytocin. So she goes even higher into this place of love. So this whole experience is very, very enjoyable, because pleasure equals love.
So if you ever wondered somewhere in your early childhood why, when you were a kid, the very first person you had sex with that was really pleasurable sex, you fell in love.
Hmm.
You know, and you said, the first time you had an orgasm, you said, that's the person I love. And you think about that person forever. Well, that's kind of the way the experience goes. Orgasm kind of puts a fixation on the spot. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. So some women experience it and some women don't. And what you're saying is modern childbirth gets in the way of that happening.
Yes.
And therefore creates all kind of complications. But we are talking about women's orgasms, and there are a number of theories as to why the orgasm evolved. And this comes from after many years of people saying that there weren't even any such thing.
As a female,
as a female orgasm, right? Do you, what was how? When did we finally recognize it? 1950 something.
I think it was in the mid 1900s that finally, you know, it was even acknowledged that a woman could have an orgasm that was not spontaneous, because of course we all know that this can happen in a dream or while sleeping, but it was not even recognized that this could happen during sex, during intercourse, or that a woman could achieve orgasm through masturbation. So it's only until recently that we were even discussing this as a possibility. And actually, when the topic was finally brought up into the light of true science, let's call it, then there was a flooding. The bookshelves of bookstores were flooded with books on female orgasm, how to achieve it, how to...
And sexuality, and know thy body, know
all
thyself.
All of a sudden, it exploded into this enormous amount of literature about the topic.
By the way, we're getting close here, and we're going to continue with this. We are going to be with you till 3 o'clock today. Those of you who are leaving us, if you have to leave us...
Don't leave us.
Don't leave us. But if you have... Everybody, this is Armand DeMille.
And this is Maria Roberta Atti, or also Roberta Maria Atti, Michael, whichever you prefer.
Hey, with you with the Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM. That's such an important time. You know, we're talking about no war and war and anti-war, pro-war. One would imagine that it's difficult to deal with whatever political stance you take, certainly. But in addition to that, there are these personal wars that we go through. The love wars. Wars with people you care about. Did you ever have a feeling that you love somebody and it's a battle? Like you want to, it's like you want to fight them, you want to beat them. One wonders why we have partnerships, love relationships, where there's hatred, disrespect. It's almost as if you think the person you love, wants to hurt you in some way. Or they believe that you want to hurt them. It's such a funny way that people relate to each other. Well, where do the love wars start? Maybe it's all biological. We've been looking, trying to get to the bottom of it. And Roberta and I have been looking particularly at the origins of human mating and reproductive behaviors. Trying to figure out where it started, or how it started, or how we got to this funny place.
Well, I say, Armand, let's make love, not war. Can I say that? The book that we have been reviewing last time and today, we're going to talk about some of the content of the book written by Dr. Leonard Schlein. This book is, the title is Sex, Time, and Power. And the book is about how women's sexuality shaped human evolution. And this has a lot to do, in a sense, with war. Although I don't like to make that connection, but...
Before you go further, let's introduce Dr. Schlein, because a lot of the people who heard what we were talking about thought he was some fly-by-night phony scientist.
No, Dr. Schlein is a very, very astute researcher, and he's also the chief of laparoscopic surgery at California Pacific Medical Center in San Francisco. And he wrote a book that Armand and I did a couple of programs on called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, which is one of the best books I've ever read, and that's the conflict between word and image. Dr. Schlein is a very thorough researcher, and he takes his time with sources and references, and anyone who is interested in his work really should take a look at these books, because at the end of the book you'll find plenty of references as to where Dr. Schlein finds his information. But
we've gone to many places with this, and we've also looked at the work of Dr. Robin Baker from London, from England, who was a zoologist in the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Manchester from 1980 to 1996. And he's left the academic life, but he's quite a scientist. And he wrote a book called The Sperm Wars. Very interesting how the two of these kind of overlap. The question we had, or what we addressed last week, what we were looking at in the first part in this series, was why did it start happening that men and women started having this kind of unusual mating behaviors? And just to review it very quickly, it seems that some 150,000 years ago, there was a critical moment, what they call an evolutionary bottleneck, where the human race was trying to adapt to its status as being an upright, standing upright kind of hominid that was out there, and there was all kinds of dangers. And what the human, tell me if I'm right, Roberta, what the human was doing. Excuse me just a second. What we were doing was he was standing upright, and they had to develop a bigger brain.
Well, what happened, Armand, was there was a branch of hominids in Africa by Lake Victoria that later became the Homo sapiens. So that's the branch of hominids that became the most successful. And we are the direct descendant of this branch of hominids. This particular branch of hominids came to a place where there was a problem. And the problem was, even though humans had been evolving through millions of years, there came a time when this very intelligent primate had to have a brain that was so large compared to the body size at that time that a lot of females were dying giving birth. And so what we talked about last week was what happened out of that evolutionary bottleneck. What happened was that about 150,000 years ago, along with many goddess religions, women took charge of the mating, of making decisions as to when to mate, who to mate with, and the mating behavior became the charge of the female gender. Now, this happened because the females were the ones dying in childbirth. And so they were the ones at stake, whose life was at stake pertaining to the mating behavior. So I guess maybe nature decided to favor them by giving them an understanding of what was going on in their bodies. And the connection was made at some point between mating, having sex, romantic encounters, and dying while giving birth to an infant 9 months later. So females supposedly made this discovery and became, for the first time in evolution, became able to override their own hormonally dictated behavior and to decide, as I said, when and where to mate, etc. So to regulate mating behavior according to thinking rather than to instinct. And that's quite a jump in evolution, Armand.
Now, if you haven't heard that program, we're going to tell you how you could listen to that and hear more about that. So that's where we kind of left you. We left you with the fact that, you know, suddenly the female of the species says, hey, I've got to be more selective. I can't afford to be 12 years old and having babies with somebody who's not going to be around to bring me iron. So I can't do that. So he says, so she's going to try to be more selective in her choosing of mates. So then out of all of this, I want you to see, we continue. We develop males and we develop females, and we get to this unusual point where things are just funny. Did you ever look at two animals mating? Mostly there's a thing that's called an ambivalence. The female of a species doesn't seem to be ever enjoying sex. She doesn't disenjoy it necessarily. It's kind of an apathy. It's kind of like, you know, you could imagine a deer who's chewing its cud while she's being mounted by some stag, you know, and it's like, all right, it's the time, I'm in estrus, yes, you do that thing, but no necessarily showing any sign of pleasure or desire. And the males did show more, didn't they, Roberta?
Yes, well, males are driven by testosterone in humans as well as animals, and testosterone is a powerful hormone that dictates sometimes aggressive behavior. But all of this, let's remember, is always in the interest of survival of the species, meaning that in animals, what you see is that males tend to fight, tend to compete more, and tend to be very focused on mating when the time is right, when the female shows signs of being fertile. Now, the female may enjoy the actual mating. The higher up in the species you go, Armand, the more it seems that females enjoy the act of...
So the actual act of enjoying sex is what we're going to be talking about today. Today we're going to talk about orgasm. Today we're going to bring you to the understanding of orgasm, particularly woman's orgasm.
Because even though for a male, from an evolutionary perspective, it is necessary for a male to have orgasm in order to reproduce, in order to have offsprings, it is not necessary for the female. So when you go and look at mating behavior, and you go and look that at some point in history, human females took over the decision of when to mate, and that was because they were dying in large numbers, then you go look at the fact that females, humans, enjoy the sexual activity more than any other animal in creation. Because when you go look at the neurotransmitters and you look at the intensity of the experience, it's much more intense for a human than it is for any other animal. Then you start asking the questions, well, if pleasure is not a requirement in order for a woman to conceive, then why should she have so much compared to any other species, given that sex for her is a death? There's a risk of death. You know what I mean, Armand? I mean, it seems that the female of the human species, being that she is the animal that risks... Did you know that no other animal, Armand, risks death with sex as much as the human does? Giving birth for most animals is not a life or death situation for the most part. It's not such a dangerous event. Most animals give birth quite naturally without much suffering, and it's not very travailed or difficult or long or nowhere near the suffering and the pathos and the danger involved for a human female. So The question that we're asking today is, okay, so the female was the one who took control of the when and where and how. But why the pleasure? Why does she like it so much? When in reality, this is one of the activities that is the most dangerous for her to engage in.
You mean orgasmic sex?
Well, itself, sex in general.
Sex in general, plus the loss of control during orgasm is also dangerous, just as it is during childbirth. Plus, the whole idea of the orgasm and what it means and how did that evolve is something that we're going to talk about. Listen, when we brought this program to you last week, we were greeted with a lot of provoked a lot of exuberant responses, both in the positive and the negative. It reminded me of the Scopes monkey trials. You remember in Inherit the Wind, it was a battle about, you know, it was a battle about was there evolution or was there not evolution?
Yes, that movie where the teacher who teaches the children about evolution.
Clarence Darrow, I believe, taken
out of a job because he's not supposed to tell children such things, right?
Right. Well, we were kind of on the receiving end of it, but then we are WBAI, so what do you expect? I mean, this is what we do here, and that's the beauty of this station.
I actually enjoyed it. I liked it that people felt so strongly about it that they wrote such long emails that looked like they had spent hours
thinking about it
and reading about it and researching about it, and people have strong feelings about this, and that's wonderful, Armand. I think it's great.
You know, as a mental health practitioner, I find it, I feel fortunate to be able to talk about many things that might be considered off color by many other people, but my interest is people getting together. My interest is people having a better understanding of each other.
Well,
some people thought of us as heretics to reduce the act of lovemaking to biological imperatives, you know? I mean, they want to sanctify sex and love and...
And one of the things that seemed to upset people very much was that in our reviewing of the work of Dr. Schlein, we presented his theory whereby he says, well, since women were the ones dying, women were the ones given the advantage of thinking, of making the connection. Well, that makes sense because men didn't have very much at stake. Men would just enjoy their sex and pick up and go. But females were left with quite an ordeal. And so it makes sense that females would slowly develop an understanding of what was going on. And now imagine what it's like for a woman to know that somewhere at some point in her life, she's going to go through this ordeal. Now, mind you, this is many thousand years ago. She has no idea of the fact that sex equals possibly a pregnancy. So she knows that some women go through this ordeal and she sees some of them are dying. And she wonders, well, will that happen to me? How can I avoid it? Or should I avoid it? Or should I not avoid it? Or what should I do with it? And I'm sure that women started to try to confer with one another. What are we going to do about this? How are we going to help Aunt Sibylla, who has a big belly, and soon maybe she's going to give birth, and maybe she's going to die? What are we going to do about that? I'm sure that all of that brought about a lot of intense preoccupation with birth in females that was not in males, because why would males worry? They didn't have to go through that. So it makes a lot of sense.
So the very act of thinking, which is what almost separates humans from all other animals, the larger capacity of the brain and the ability to do complex thought, started with females saying, how am I going to stop him from doing the deed? The origin of thinking.
The original thought.
And it was basically, should I eat the apple or should I not eat the apple? It's another version of it.
Mm-hmm.
The original thought was, well, you know, how am I going to keep this guy away?
Right.
How am I going to keep them away? How am I going to be selective? How am I going to pick the right mate?
Why doesn't he get pregnant?
Yeah, and this
How is, come he doesn't get a big belly? I'm sure they thought of that, Armand. I would have, right?
Well, it's the same conflict that people live with today. in another form. How do I find the best mate? How do I find him? What do I do with him? What do I choose? Why don't I just have sex with everybody? You know, and what's the difference? And it's kind of amazing how we've come around to it. You know, we've kind of come around to right back to the original struggle in a very interesting way. Now, we're going to be talking about orgasm because orgasm is very confusing. I mean, here's some just simple facts about orgasm. A woman's orgasm is much more accessible after she has birth. Is that true? After she has babies?
You mean
babies?
After she has had children?
After she's had children, right?
Yes, it seems that women that have never had a child have a more difficult time achieving orgasms than women who have.
And there are many other facts like that, which we're going to learn about today as you stay with us. This is Armand DeMille and Roberta Atti.
Another thing is that it's so unevenly distributed. I mean, orgasm is not something that every woman experiences, and it doesn't seem to have any rhyme or reason. There's no prediction as to who is going to experience it or who is not. There's no need for it to occur in order for the woman to conceive, as we said before. And in other words, sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't.
Well, there is some theory about why it is necessary. There is some biological theory about how it is necessary. The orgasm is necessary as a way. And these three theories are called the pole-axe theory. What are the other two theories?
The upsuck.
The upsuck theory and the cuddle theory.
Yes. And then there is one more, which is concerning the G-spot.
Okay.
All right.
Now,
but, you know, what's interesting also, Armand, is for centuries, the female orgasm was not even taken into account, was not even acknowledged, so that females were not considered orgasmic by science. It's just the past century that finally it has been acknowledged that it does occur and that females of the human species have such a capacity to experience deep, intense pleasure during sex that does not occur in any other species except some tropical fish in the... No, I'm kidding. It does not happen for any other animal, only humans.
Let me give you an example of one, my friends. The G-spot, supposed G-spot, that was named after...
Oh, he's got a one
got
of those
G
names.
Names, right?
Granberg,
Grambenflicken, somebody.
Yeah, he has one of those German names that we're going to get. But the G-spot was named after him because he's the one who discovered the G-spot. I'll tell you in a second what his name is.
And it's a particular spot in the human organism, right?
So he was a gynecologist, Ernst Grafenberg.
Grafenberg.
Grafenberg, okay. G-spot, yes.
So
Ernst.
Ernst Grafenberg, Grafenberg decided, identified a spot in the human...
birth canal.
That had a that if when a pressure were put against it, it could result in the release of an orgasm. Right?
We're
am
watching the
it
language,
right?
By the way.
Well, not necessarily. Am I saying okay. It accurately?
No.
Okay, say it accurately.
Dr. Grafenberg located a place in the human vagina located in the front of the canal. That when pushed, when pressure was applied to that spot, the brain of the woman would secrete large amounts of endorphins. And again, no one knew why this is there, because even when you look at the normal position that humans engage when they have intercourse, normally there's not even friction on that place in the woman's vagina. So why would it be there at all? And of course, this is the punchline, so we're not going to tell you now, but this is one of the questions we're going to address.
Well, actually, you know what I'm going to do, Roberta?
Because you're going to go against your own rules?
I'm going to go The reason that I think we're going to go to this and explain this is because I want people to understand how interesting and fascinating it is to learn about this. Because here we're talking about a spot in the human anatomy, in the female anatomy.
The Grafenberg spot.
Right, the G-spot, which some people even still to this day deny the existence of, which presents an orgasm that's different than the other kind of orgasm, which is a clitoral orgasm. And they say by pressure on this spot, there is a release of endorphins, and it's such a severe pressure that some people experience it and other people don't. Other women do not seem to have this response.
Okay, well, I think the G-spot is present in every woman, but not every woman knows that it's there. So whether a woman has experienced the pleasure connected with it or not may just be because she doesn't know it's there. It may also be that the position in which she has intercourse does not allow for stimulation of that place. It may be that her mate is anatomically structured in such a way that it does not lead to friction of that place. So it may be that that spot is possible to locate or to find in every woman, but that just not every woman has had the experience
now,
of feeling it.
The reason I mention it, I've heard both theories. I've heard some people say it doesn't exist in some women and other women it does. But there's a real question about why this would be there in the first place. Why do you think? I mean, the great designer said, oh, and for kicks, we'll give a woman a G-spot. And
that would not have been a bad idea on the part of the designer. Why not?
Because I think that didn't work that way. Nature didn't work
right.
That way.
No,
it wasn't that frivolous. There was a real reason.
Right.
And it turns out that this very spot, this place called the G-spot, is a time that a woman will use this spot. This spot will be essential and necessary at one particular time, which brings us back 150,000 years ago, to when the size of the head was getting bigger and births were more life-threatening and painful, much more painful than they have been for other animals. So what happens at that time, Roberta, with the G-spot?
Well, this is Dr. Schlein's theory that the location of the spot is such, as I said before, that it's not normally stimulated during normal intercourse, which makes it even more puzzling when you go and ask, why is it there? But when you look at the anatomy and physiology of labor and delivery of children, what you'll notice is that at the last stage of labor, where the head of the child passes into the birth canal, so it comes out of the cervix, which has been dilating through contractions, dilating, and then it finally gets to the point where it can accommodate the diameter of the baby's skull. So now the head of the baby comes down into the birth canal about to exit the body of the woman. It hits precisely the G-spot as it enters the birth canal. So at the moment when the woman is experiencing the most excruciating pain of her life, a pain that she can never even imagine unless she's been there, a pain that is enough to feel like one is dying from the pain itself, let alone the bleeding and everything else, at that moment, she also has the opportunity of experiencing the most ecstatic pleasure of her life, a pleasure that has no equals, because the pressure of the head, the hard skull of the baby, compressing the G-spot, causes the G-spot to send nerve impulses to the brain, and these nerves are connected to spots in the brain that are directly responsible for secreting endorphins. So as the baby's skull compresses the G-spot, what you have is a profuse secretion of endorphins that give the woman the sense that she is in absolute bliss. And in fact, during delivery, many women experience the best orgasm of their lives.
And this is part of the amazing form of nature. In addition, it creates a bond between the mother and the fetus. Because right. it's like you've had your first orgasm in your life. You know, you fall in love. It's an amazing thing. This is Armand DeMille with you with Roberta Maria Anti. I wanted to show you that one particular spot. We've discovered much more. And when we come back from our break, we're going to be talking to you to much more about the origin of sexuality. We are right back, Roberta.
So what we were saying was that giving birth is a result of having sex. And we were saying that that's a dangerous activity for a woman to engage in. We were saying that at a point during evolution, the ancestors, Homo sapiens, came to a point where there was a problem with childbirth because the baby's head was too big.
Three types of orgasm. Let's go there. We've been promising.
And we were talking about, yes, the fact that we don't even understand why the woman experienced so much pleasure with sex, although, given that it's a death-involving activity, it would make sense that at least there should be something rewarding about
it. There are three theories.
And so far, we talked about the G-spot. Now we're going to talk about three theories. That these are the preferred theories of evolutionary biologists and sexologists and anthropologists as to why the human female seems to experience a more pleasurable orgasm than any other species.
They're called the pole theory?
These are the pole X theory, the upsuck theory, and the cuddle theory. And this is always according to the book by Dr. Schlein, Sex, Time, and Power, How Women's Sexuality Shaped Human Evolution. So let's start with the pole X theory. Armand, this one starts with having to explain that human anatomy presents a problem for conception. In most mammals, or in most higher species, or in every other species, actually, the woman's reproductive organs are located in the body in such a way that the birth canal, or the conception vessel, is parallel to the ground, meaning it's horizontal, meaning that when a seed is deposited into it, the conception vessel holds it like a cradle. But in the woman, in the human, and it's the only species that has this problem, in the human, the vagina has moved from the back of the pelvis to the front, and now it is located vertical, so it is perpendicular to the ground, so that when the sperm is deposited in there, in the conception vessel, we have a problem that it falls out.
Let me simplify this a little. Because women walk on two legs as opposed to four legs, they are not, the birth canal is actually different. It's not parallel to the ground. So therefore, since if someone has sex with an animal that has four legs, the animal is walking around and the seed is kind of hanging in there. You know, it's not going anywhere. But the trouble is that since women tend to stand up and walk around like men do, and they walk around standing, it tends to fall out. It drops out. It doesn't move towards fertilizing the egg. So one theory about orgasm is that the reason that the women were given an orgasm on the completion of sex or during sex,
so pleasurable.
That one is that it's so pleasurable.
So pleasurable. That's the most important part of it. That the reason why the orgasm in a female is experienced so deeply by the woman
is because it knocks her out.
Right. If you see a pair of dogs mating or a pair of horses, any kind of animal, you see that right after mating, the female just walks away. Lions and the lioness, tigers, they just, you know, the mating ends and the female moves away. She goes to eat or take care of other cubs, whatever. Now, and in those species, which are the higher species of mammals, where already the female shows some kind of pleasure associated with sex, but not nearly as much as humans. In those species, if a woman behaved like that, meaning if the woman had no pleasure in sex and she just walked away from it, most likely conception would be very difficult. But if you knock her on the head with the poleaxe, with the hammer of orgasm, meaning that she's flooded with neurotransmitters that make her relaxed and make her
knocked out,
then
knocked
she's
out.
Gonna
she tends to want to go to
stay
sleep
at least for a few minutes lying down, and that facilitates conception.
So it's really a process of fertilization. By giving a woman an orgasm as part of her mating behavior, it is possible that if she has an orgasm during sex, she will want to remain not standing up. It's called the poleaxe theory because it's like getting hit in the back of the head with a handle, and that was where the theory came from. I'm sure it was a male.
Well,
theory.
Because otherwise, if the woman just walks away, chances are that the sperm will leak out and conception would be much
more difficult. It just sounds like, you know, the kind of a theory that was named by a man, as opposed to a woman who might have given it the pillow theory. You know,
sure.
Call it the pillow theory, saying, oh, and this makes a woman want to lay her head down on a pillow.
Sure, yes. The naming of it, I was kind of surprised, actually. But all three names are a bit, you know, they're not my favorite names. I wouldn't call these theories with these names, but
you know what I think, Roberta? I think when men were doing research on women, and male gynecologists very often are angry, and their anger bleeds through. We should put an expression, bleeds through.
Yeah.
It kind of comes through in the way they talk in their descriptions. Because now let's take the next theory, which is called the, what is it called? The suckle up?
Upsuck.
The upsuck.
Yes.
Theory.
Actually, I saw a film of this. I saw a video where this had been put onto a film. So this theory says, now we're going to get into the physiology of intercourse. Penetration will cause the vagina to stretch and will move the location of the cervix of the woman, so that the cervix is no longer at the bottom of the vagina, but it moves kind of slightly up to the front. The woman is lying down. The sperm is deposited deep into the vagina, and because of the stretching that occurs, let's say that there is a pocket that forms at the end of the vagina, and the pocket becomes like a kind of like a little valley,
a pool
in there, so that the sperm that is deposited into the vagina really forms a pool in the pocket that has formed, caused by the stretching. But also remember now that the cervix has moved practically directly above this pool, okay? And I'm trying to give a description.
It's not working, I promise.
Well, I'm trying because, of course, through the radio.
But nobody sees your hands.
Okay, well.
Anyway, let's just assume that the contractions cause a sucking motion that draws the sperm upward to the cervix.
The cervix, actually, if you see the film, the cervix dips into the pool of sperm as the woman experiences the contractions of orgasm. And this is why they call it the upsuck theory, because the cervix is seen picking up sperm. Now, when you, for instance, have an instance of a rape or non-consensual sex or sex that the woman does not enjoy or there's no orgasm, the cervix will not do that. And so that conception is much harder to achieve because there's no movement of the cervix in that way. And so that's another explanation for orgasm.
Armand DeMille here with you. If you're just passing by and wondering what's going on radio, and you tuned into the beautiful voice of Roberta Atti, you will hear us talking about vaginas and sex and orgasm and sperm and stuff like that, because we're exploring some of the origins of mating behaviors. And this is part two in a series as we're talking about it. So one is the Pollack theory, the other is the Upsuck theory of orgasm. Why do women have orgasms? This is a question. Why was that built into nature since no other animal seems to have them? I mean, no other animal seems to be going through them, right?
No, the no spasms. Other animal seems to have the intensity of the pleasure that a woman experiences. But no other animal dies as much as women die in childbirth. So we also need to say that women are the only species that, A, by the time she's done with her fertile years, she loses approximately 4 to 5 gallons of blood. Between menses and childbirth losses and all of the blood that's lost through reproductive activity, gallons, Armand, 4 to 5 gallons are lost. So already there's a tremendous demand on the body of the woman just from the blood loss itself. But then if you look at mortality among young women, childbirth is has historically been one of the highest causes of early death. So it would make sense that nature would make it at least a pleasurable activity, right? And what we're describing are the theories that anthropologists and sexologists have come up with to explain why orgasm in females.
You know, a little later we also want to talk about some of the difference between, some of the strangest things, like the most fertile years for a woman is during the most fertile years for a woman is when she's in her 30s, and the most fertile time for a young man is when he's in his early 20s or late teens. And it would seem like the way nature designed it should be women should be with teenage men. Do you know what I mean? I mean, that's the design. We're going to talk about why it seems not to be true. Why is it true that men seem to be attracted to younger women and women are attracted to older men? That's also going to be a part of what we're doing. But before we do, Roberta, let's go to that third theory. We've talked about the Pollack theory of why orgasm exists. And then we talked about the Upsuck theory, and it may be both, mind you, because both could be going on. You could be poleaxed and upsucked at the same time.
Oh, Armand.
No, I don't mean that in a derogatory way.
I know.
It does sound terrible.
It sounded terrible.
I know. I'm sorry. So what's the third theory?
The cuddle theory.
This sounds nice, huh?
It's better than the others, yes. But actually, in order to get into the cuddle theory, we need to talk about precisely what you just mentioned, which is the orgasmic capacity is not matched between the two genders, time-wise. And now this goes into
a lengthy theory. The cuddle theory without doing that?
No, because it's part of it.
Oh, boy, because, you know, there's just a matter of timing. I'll tell you what.
But there's quite a long
explanation. We're going to have to hold that. Yes, there is.
Yeah.
Why the cuddle and why the differences in the sexuality? And we're going to have to hold that. Because we have some station ID and things to do. This is Armand DeMille with you with Roberta. Armand DeMille, Roberta Auntie, here we are. That was a funny thing. I was expecting Michael to break in and give us a station ID. Hey, listen, Roberta, let's go right to it. The cuddle theory of why women have orgasms.
Mm. Okay.
Right?
That's the one that's going to take
the longest. I mean, we know why men have
sporgasms. Sport orgasms?
Sport orgasms. Right, to drive them, right? It makes sex more fun, makes it more frequent, but, I mean, that's the male thing. He's going to drive to do it. And the orgasm itself pushes the sperm along. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And we're going to talk more about that.
Anatomically, yes.
We're going to talk more about that. We need to talk more about that, and I think it's going to maybe take another program. But go ahead. Talk about this cuddle-down theory.
Okay. Well, what we said a few minutes ago was that there's a mismatch between the ages at which a woman and a man are orgasmically more active or competent, I should say. A man is more likely to be the most capable of reaching repeated orgasms in the early teens. So let's say between 13 and 18. a woman is more likely to reach orgasm or even repeated orgasms in her 30s. So it would make sense that the match, the ideal match, should be between a teenager, male, and a woman in her 30s, whereas we know that it's quite the contrary. When we think of couples, usually we think of the male being the older one and the female being the younger one, and most men like younger women and most women like older males. Of course, I don't want to stereotype, but just generally, if you ask most people, this is what they would say. And this is the image that we're used to. And this has to do, again, with how society, how human society, how human behavior, how human, the cultural stratus has developed through sexuality, has shaped the whole of human culture and social structure. So that was a convoluted sentence, but I'm going to get right to it. The cuddle theory. So it takes a lot longer for a woman to reach orgasm than it does for a man, usually. The older the woman is, the shorter the time seems. The older the woman is, the more likely she is to get there. The older the woman is, the easier it is for her to experience it, and to experience it when she decides to, meaning that it's within her control, either through intercourse or through masturbation. A male, the younger he is, the more likely he is to ejaculate prematurely, meaning that his difficulty is with withholding the ejaculation, not with arriving at it. So what we have here is, in a man's fantasy, the ideal sex, the sex that he considers the easiest, the most desirable, is one where he meets a woman he does not know. He has sex with her without any kind of commitment, without any kind of promise, without any kind of emotional involvement. He just penetrates her and mates with her. And then the two separate and never meet one another again. Now, this is a fantasy, and I'm not stereotypifying human males in the sense that I'm saying they don't care, but I'm saying in the fantasy of a male, sex is very simple. It's a simple activity in which he mates with a female, and that's it. That's all that's required. And that's just because physiologically, his nervous system, his brain is wired that way, is wired to have sex with as many females as possible so that his seed can spread far and wide, always in the interest of survival of the species, always in the interest of the best odds for reproduction, so that this is how he's wired. He has no fault at this. It's not by his choice that this is how he's wired.
He builds up a lot of sperm, and he feels the need to relieve it frequently. If he's a young teenage guy, he's getting rid of this, and he's dumping it all the time.
The younger he is, the more he wants to mate. But for him, mating is just mating. There is no desire for long-term commitment.
For most teenage
concern,
boys,
there's no concern for how she feels about it. And I'm not saying this in a bad way, mind you. Right. I'm talking about the perspective of the nervous system.
Way nature built it. He is wired to have the most sperm that are viable at a certain age, at a certain time, and he's got to get that around as much as possible. And they have shown that he has a more potent sperm, or more, whatever that is called, when he doesn't know, when it's a female that he's unfamiliar with.
That makes sense also. But you see when you think of the way that nature designed this, nature designed it with the best interest of the species in mind. The best interest of the species says, primitive people, the more he mates, the more offsprings there will be, the younger he is, the healthier he is, the stronger he is, the more females he can impregnate. the younger his sperm is, the healthier it is, the stronger the offspring are going to be. So in that sense, it makes perfect sense, Armand, that the male should be wired that way.
But okay, now so let's make sure we get to what we're female. Talking about, which is the woman's
orgasm.
The
side of the female says, okay, here is a male who is wired that way, but what is my share in this? What is my responsibility in this? Well, what I know about myself and about my reproductive structure is that once I get pregnant, I am going to most likely become dependent on someone, something, some form of support that is going to feed me, feed my baby, allow me to be there for my baby so that I can feed the baby. I am most likely going to be in need of support structurally through society or through a mate. So what I need is to find a mate that is going to give me that support, because if I'm going to have his child, I have to make sure that he's not going to just going to mate and run off.
Which is what the tendency is
of
to
males
do.
Is.
So what the male is built to mate and just go off and mate again and go off, and since variation is stimulating, he's going to go from one to another, not to the same one over and over again.
Yes, because the same can only conceive one child every 5-6 years.
So by nature, he's going to just go bopping around.
And
you
that
know?
Makes sense, behaviorally it makes sense for him. But she has to mind that, because if she chose that hypersexual teenager ready to mate with every woman in sight but not interested in a long-term commitment, she would most likely be abandoned, because, you know, this is a young male who is not ready to take on the responsibility of a family. So what
when you hear stories about the woman who is the married woman at home who is making love with the 17-year-old pool attendant, she wants just teenage boy who's going to come in and go away.
Yes, that's an adventure for her as it is for him.
It's adventure, not just work. You're matching the 30-year-old with the 17-year-old.
But that's not for reproduction.
But it's usually not the preference.
And it's not for reproduction. That's just for fun, right? It's not. You're not going to start a family if you're a 35-year-old woman and you mate with a 19-year-old young man because of the fun of it. You're not thinking of starting a family with this man, most likely. You're just thinking of having some fun. But if you want to start a family, and for a woman, there's always that question mark, am I going to get pregnant? And so much of her life is invested in this that she's going to have to be very discerning as to who she looks for. So she's going to look for a male who shows that he cares enough about her, he loves her enough, he is concerned and committed, and he wants to stay with her and protect her and take care of her enough that, especially when they mate, he's going to care more about her pleasure than his own. So he's going to be able to delay his own or to really even eliminate it. It's not important for him as much as it is for her to enjoy sex. If she sees that this is how her mate is during sex, she can possibly hope that this is a mate that will not abandon her, that will not run off and go mate with another 100 women, will not impregnate her and leave, and will stay for the long haul, which means will provide the meat, will provide the shelter, will provide the protection and all of that she needs when she's going to have that baby.
So a male who is older is attractive to a female, I hate to use female, a woman who is younger, right? Because maybe if she's in her 30s and 40s, she'll like the older man because he takes longer to have an orgasm. And
basically,
because he takes longer to have an orgasm, it is interpreted by her body as somebody who cares about her pleasure.
Right.
So men who are...
That if she should get pregnant by this man, he's more likely to be a caring father also.
And he's likely to take care of her.
Right, and of the child.
And even if she doesn't, you know, even if she doesn't get pregnant, he's likely to take care of her.
More so than a young male who's all over the place.
Who's going to be all over the place and have many impulses. So in the cuddle theory...
In the cuddle theory, it's that...
Of why women have orgasms.
Yes, but also why it takes so long for a woman to have it versus the male, you see? Because in the cuddle theory, what's also noticed is that there's a mismatch in the timing. A woman, it takes her much longer to achieve orgasm than it does for a male. But if the male is willing to postpone his own in order to wait for her and make sure she's satisfied, then she's more likely to have found a mate that is going to be a good mate and a good father. So nature gave woman orgasm because the pleasure of sex, it makes the risk of death almost worth it. But also, it made her orgasm more difficult to achieve because it requires, on the part of the male, more of the patience that he's going to show, that is going to tell her that he's a good mate. You see?
Wow. It's great. I mean, it's convoluted and it's really fascinating. So, therefore, a woman will be attracted, in general, to an older man, right?
Right.
If she's looking for somebody to have babies with, it's kind of interesting because, you know, the women I've known who are attracted to younger men, they're not interested in having children.
Well, yes. In fact, there's another part of this that I was going to discuss if we have the
time.
Go ahead.
We've got about 5 minutes.
Okay, well, this is actually a turn of events that has only come about during the past few thousand years, ever since there's been a switch from matriarchal to patriarchal society. Because in the matriarchal society and the matrilineal societies and in the societies where the goddess was the divinity and where women had more control in owned properties, etc., children were raised by the community, by the tribe. Children, in other words, the woman who was impregnated didn't have to worry about who's going to take care of my child because the tribe was going to feed all children to the point where sometimes in a tribe a woman will forget who her child is, I've read, because all the children belong to everyone. But when there was a shift and it became a patriarchal society where then we have a male divinity and we have a male dominated controlled structure, now the woman depends on the male because you no longer have the communal raising of children by all the women of all the tribe. And what you have now is the woman depends on the mate for support, no longer on the tribe. Now you have women who are attracted to older men because they need the mate who's going to support them. When you have a woman who's not interested in children or who knows that her children are going to be fed and taken care of regardless, she's going to be attracted to the younger male, of course, because that's more fun. You see?
So we're back to the woman in the suburbs who is hiring with the newsman,
sure,
right?
Sure.
Because, sure, you could play with the boys.
As long as there's no reproduction involved.
Everything is taken care of.
As long as there's no reproduction involved, you don't need the mate to take care of you and the baby. But once you start talking about impregnation and childbirth and having children and family to raise, now you have women who want the older male because, and the cuddle theory explains why her orgasm takes so long to come versus his, because she wants him to cuddle to make sure that he's going to be a good mate. And a young teenager male is not going to cuddle.
What do you mean, cuddle? She wants him.
She wants him to show that he has the patience and he wants to cuddle. He wants to give her that sense of
And really
caring.
What it is with a lot of older men, once they have an orgasm, they want to go to sleep.
But
even that is being there.
Yes, being there, not running off
it
and wanting
bonding.
To mate with another woman in the next hour. You see, the older male is more likely to hold her, to spend time with her, to show her that he cares enough by taking longer to have sex with her. A younger male is going to be just, you know, the quick thing, and then he's going to be off and running. So it makes sense that the woman who thinks of conceiving is looking for an older male. But this wasn't always true. It's been true in the patriarchal, let's say, the last maybe 3,000 years or so.
It certainly is fascinating, Roberta. You know, we could go on for a very long period of time, and it's the kind of thing that Roberta and I will continue to work with you, my friends. We're going to bring this all back to you and talk about this even more.
Oh, there's a lot more that we can talk about on the subject of sexuality.
Right?
Yes, but what and, we but need about, now
I think
is
what we've
support.
Just said about woman's orgasm is a very, very important piece. We'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes, my friends. And we're back. This is Armando Mill with you. A little choppy on this program that you're hearing today, on the CD you're hearing today, because we were eliminating some music and pitching we were doing. But Roberta, so here we've heard four different kind of theories, or many different theories that people have kind of made up about the origin, or considered or researched about the origin of a woman's orgasm. And I guess it was important, but I mean, the origin doesn't matter as much as really an understanding of what it is and how it operates and how it functions. Do you have any belief one way or another? Do you think that it's Axe theory, or what was that called?
You mean if I have any theory as to why females of the human species have orgasms?
Yeah, what do you think?
I think that it's an expression of love, and that love is evolutionary, the most successful strategy that has been found by any species. And I think humans, as much as they are capable of destruction and cruelty and hatred and disrespect and betrayal and horrible things, humans are also able to love in a deeper, it seems like to me, a more intense way than any other species. And that all of these strategies, like female orgasm, in the end lead to a deeper experience of love between mates, and love between mother and child, and love between parents. So that is, to me, that's the most successful strategy that any organism can come up with. I think orgasm intensifies the love that a woman or a man feels towards his or her mate, and that's ultimately the reason why it occurs. In humans, it occurs more intensely than in animals, because humans are able to love more than animals. Or no, I shouldn't say that. I believe that animals love, but that humans have a kind of love that is exclusively human, and I think that orgasm intensifies that, and that ultimately is the best strategy for survival.
Makes a lot of sense to me, Roberta. Thank you very much. Thanks for being with me and sharing this part of it. I know we're going to continue it.
Fascinating, huh?
Yeah.
Human sexuality is really what determined a lot of the structure of human society. And that's why I like to explore it and to see, you know, what did people do that led to where we are today? Good and bad.
Okay, my friends, we'll be back with you with our next installment of this. Thanks for being with us today.